Okay, go for zero G this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. We'll revisit the intersection of science and art this week as we talk with Damian Kulash and Tim Nordwin, the band OK Go. Their new video, shot in a zero-G airplane, gathered nearly 50 million views in its first 5 days on Facebook. President Obama has released his budget proposal for 2017. 700 pages of it are devoted to NASA. We'll get first impressions from Casey Dreyer. Later, I'll join Bruce Betts in his astronomy classroom to learn what's up in the current night sky, and you'll get another shot at the space trivia contest. Emily Lakdawalla is the Planetary Society's senior editor. Emily, our topic this week, I don't want to get my or anybody else's hopes up, but it sure sounds, if you'll pardon the expression, like we have another shot at getting something terrific on Mars.
Yes, I really hope it works out. But like you said, our hopes have been dashed before, so we'll have to wait and see. But yes, there's a possibility that there could be a microphone included on the next Mars lander, the Mars 2020 rover.
Of course, there are more details in this blog entry, which is this time from you and Bruce Betts. What's going on?
Well, the Planetary Society has been trying to get a microphone onto the surface of Mars for decades. And as a matter of fact, we succeeded once. Unfortunately, the lander didn't, and our microphone is embedded in the surface of Mars near the South Pole with Mars Polar Lander. There was also a microphone actually on Phoenix that never got turned on for very complicated historical reasons. So it hasn't been done yet. Every single time we land something on Mars, people constantly ask me, is there a microphone on this one? And I have to say no. So I'm really hoping that it will work out this time for public relations purposes, but also, as the blog entry details, it'll be good for science too.
Just give us a little bit of an idea of how this would help this instrument called SuperCam to do its work.
The main way that it would help do its work is that the volume of the sound, the intensity of the sound pulse produced, is directly proportional to the amount of mass that this laser blasts off the surface of whatever rock it's trying to study. And that information will help scientists interpret the results of their laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy of the rock. It's also useful for measuring wind speed. At least it's an independent constraint on what wind speed is. And it actually could be useful for engineering, too, just to be able to monitor the kinds of sounds that the rover makes as it's going about its ordinary operations on Mars.
All well and good, and this is how we're going to get there, but is anybody not thinking about us hearing the breeze pass a spacecraft on the surface of Mars?
Just pause and think about it for a second. And it's appropriate that there is a moment of silence there, because we've never recorded sounds from the surface of Mars.
Well, fingers crossed. Thank you so much, Emily. Talk to you again next week.
See you then, Matt.
She's our senior editor, the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. You can also check out her latest update from Curiosity and learn what a thwack actuator is. No Bill Nye this week. He has given up his spot so that we can have a conversation with the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy, Casey Dreyer, here to talk about the new NASA budget, or at least the one proposed by the president. Casey, I know there's much more going on with this president's budget request than we're going to be able to cover in 2 or 3 minutes. So I look forward to one of those longer conversations with you and your colleague in space policy, Jason Callahan. But give us a couple of headlines here, beginning with what's going on with planetary science.
Matt, the story of planetary science at NASA has been the story of a number. Your listeners know, my readers know, that the Planetary Society has been arguing for $1.5 billion minimum to have a healthy, balanced program of planetary exploration. The last 5 years have seen cuts to planetary science by the White House, not hitting this number. Lo and behold, for the 2017 budget request, what do we see? $1.52 billion requested for planetary science. This is the highest amount that they've requested, I think, ever, not adjusted for inflation. And now I will tell you why that is no longer enough for planetary science. But it's true. You know, this is a great number. This is one of those budgets where we have good news and bad news, which is great because mostly it's been bad news in the past. But for planetary science, we needed $1.5 billion 4 years ago to keep a healthy program. Many, many missions have been delayed. There's very few missions in the pipe coming down to build. We need to recover this program. We need to make the next generation of spacecraft that will be replacing the aging, decrepit is maybe too strong a word, but older spacecraft that are going to be dying here in the next few years. And so last year, Congress gave planetary science $1.6 billion, $1.63 billion. That is what we are pushing for now in 2017. We want to see Congress continue and extend that to let it grow with inflation. That'll help Europa stay on track for early 2020s. That'll keep Mars 2020 on track for 2020 and allow these new missions, Discovery, New Frontiers, these smaller missions to move forward. This is what we need to recover and rebuild this program. And this is what we will be arguing to Congress again. But at the very basic level, the president's request has been moving in the right direction, and that is definitely because of what we've been doing at the society, mainly what our members have been doing, letting the government know that this is important to them.
Give us some idea of what's known as the top line, the overall NASA budget requested by the president.
The top line budget, $19 billion requested for NASA. That is a solid number. That is a good number for this administration. It's $300 million less than the great number Congress provided to NASA last year. And so once again, we'll be going to Congress and asking them to continue the great work that they did in 2016 into 2017. So it's an okay number, and there's some weird gimmicky stuff that we'll talk about in our longer conversation. There's a lot of interesting stuff to unpack in the 700-page NASA document.
Wow.
And it's way too much to talk about in 3 minutes, that's for sure.
All right, Casey, you just keep burying yourself in those 700 pages, and we'll have that conversation very soon, hopefully as soon as next week, bringing Jason Callahan in for a much deeper discussion of this proposed budget just issued by the administration in D.C. And, you know, maybe you folks out there, if you want to participate, tweet us or tweet me. It's at PlanRad, at PLANRAD, or you can add a comment to Casey's most recent blog about this. We'll bring you into the conversation that way. We are now just moments away from talking to the band OK Go about making music in zero G. Which of OK Go's videos was the first to make your jaw drop? For me, it was the Rube Goldberg machine that helped them perform This Too Shall Pass. But you may go all the way back to the treadmill video that changed the perception of what a band could do in this medium. On Thursday, February 11th, the same day we learned that gravity waves are real, OK Go said, "Gravity Schmavity," slipped the surly bonds of Earth, and released the first professional music video created in zero G. I didn't know my jaw could drop any lower. Just 2 days before the release, I sat down with Damian Kulash and Tim Nordwind, the two guys who met in summer camp when they were 11 years old. They've been working, playing, and making art together ever since. Among other things, we talked about the tremendous amount of work that went into creating Inside Out and Upside Down on a very special Russian airplane. It climaxed in the 8 stomach-churning parabolas that you see in the video, though they make it look like one long, glorious ride into performance history. I cannot tell you guys how excited I am to talk to you. I could barely sleep last night because you guys with this video have realized something that I've been dreaming of since at least the Skylab days, maybe 40 years ago. So it is an honor. Congratulations on this magnificent piece of work.
Thank you so much. It's been such a dream of ours for a long time, too. And honestly, I can't believe it happened. We made a video in zero G.
It's truly unbelievable that we pulled this off.
And we're going to get into that. The line that I thought of many, many years ago when I was thinking about what could artists do in space is this one, with apologies to Pete Townsend. Weightless will surely take the mind where minds can't usually go. Any truth in that?
Yes, it'll take the mind and the stomach to places that are not meant to go. You know, when there was that sort of buzz around space exploration and travel going commercial, like almost 10 years ago now, it was like the early days of SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and stuff. I remember thinking then something clicked and I was like, oh my God, people are going to be making art in space. Like, we have to get moving quick, you know? And so for almost 10 years, we've been looking for the opportunity to do this. Of course, we're not actually in space. We're in a parabolic airplane. So we're flying in this kind of, you know, this sine wave, essentially. And each parabola gives us just about 30 seconds of weightlessness. Mm. So, if you know, when you think about how you're going to make that, for 3 minutes of video, you need 10 of those parabolas, essentially, 8, 10 of those parabolas. And to practice that, you need 10 times or 100 times longer than that. So it just seemed impossible that we would ever actually get the logistics together. I'm still sort of surprised it actually happened.
It's also like, it's just such a foreign feeling once you're weightless. You know, it's just like, you think like, oh, well, maybe we have an idea of how we'll move up there. But then you're like, wait, I don't know how to move up here. It's just like, you just start swimming around and, you know, you just have to figure out a whole new vocabulary for movement up there.
Yeah, how do you rehearse choreography in 1G that's going to be performed in zero?
All we could rehearse in 1G in normal circumstances were basic movements. Like, okay, during this part, the camera will move back and I'll fly towards the camera. I'll think of something to do when we start practicing it. At that point, I'll fly back. You guys will do something on the ceiling. You know, sort of these very basic tricks. I mean, we would never be able to plan out something this complicated without actually just testing it a lot. So what we usually do is we've gotten pretty good at picking out which ideas look promising to have a full arc, that look more than just 30 seconds of a cool idea, something that you could have this idea and from within that idea you could have another idea, that sort of range. And having located something like that, in this case, we're going to shoot in zero G, then we just get there. We just go, we get in the circumstances as fast as we can and start playing as much as we can. In this case, that meant going to the Cosmonaut Training Center outside of Moscow for a week. We did 6 flights and just played. Like the whole time, we'd set it up basically so that we could test as many things as we could imagine. We tested liquids of all sorts of viscosities. We tested every kind of fabric we could think of. Like, is there a difference between putting a canvas shirt in the air and letting it sit there or a silk scarf? And at the same time, the band were just literally bouncing off the walls, just trying to figure out what sorts of tricks we could do and repeat. You imagine something, then you try it. Next parabola comes around, you try it again. Can you do the same thing again? Like, we had no idea what would work and what didn't. So after that week, we had built a basic vocabulary of the tricks we thought made the most sense. We then came back to the States, and for 2 weeks, we mapped that stuff out. You know, in normal 1G, we went to a dance studio and we set up some chairs and we're like, okay, you do something interesting here. I'll move that way. I'll do something interesting there. The camera will follow us back. You know, those basic blocking things
I remember during that time too, there was a lot of in 1G rehearsing. There was a lot of like, and then I'll be like, and then Damon, you're like, boom.
Sound effects are important.
Yeah, sound effects are important when rehearsing in 1G.
Yeah,
for zero G.
Then when we got back to Russia, we had a full week of rehearsal. So at that point, we had a basic sort of skeleton of the shape. It was like we had it broken down into 8 scenes, each of which has a parabola to it. You know, in each scene, we knew basically where we were supposed to wind up with the rule that if you don't get there by the end of the scene, wherever you land, that's where you start the next scene. You just have to sit there through the double gravity that happens, sit there for the 5 minutes of reset, back through double gravity as the plane's about to throw you into the air again. And then as soon as the music starts and zero and gravity lifts off, that's when you restart the routine.
Yeah.
In between sections of zero gravity, you actually go through double gravity twice. And of course, then there's a long period of just sitting there too. So there was a lot of just sitting very, very still in kind of weird circumstances.
There are comfortable ways to deal with double gravity, and then there are really uncomfortable ways to deal with double gravity. Like if you get caught standing in double gravity, that's really tough because you're just feeling, you know, you're feeling like twice your body weight just come down on you.
Which you could see. There was at least one time when at least a couple of you were standing, and you could see the arms and legs flexing a little bit.
Yeah, or even kneeling. Damien gets caught kneeling a couple times. Mm.
Yeah, there's. I was the most comfortable with the vestibular chaos. Your vestibular system, the system that keeps you in balance and deals with the inputs to your brain that are telling you, wait, we're moving this way. No, we're not moving this way. What's going on with your body? I didn't freak out as much as the other guys did. So I wound up doing some slightly more difficult maneuvers. There's one of the transitions that I stand through the whole thing, which means standing through double gravity a couple times right after having done a lot of flips and right before doing a lot of other flips. And there's one right after the third scene of the video where I do a lot of flips and land on my knees. And once I actually fully passed out, when the double gravity happened, I just, the blood went out of my head, I guess, and I just passed out.
Well, you're in good company. Forget how many, it's like 1 in 3 or 1 in 5 astronauts get zero G or microgravity sickness. Did anybody get sick?
Everybody wanted to get sick. Luckily, the band were on pretty heavy anti-nausea medicines, so none of us actually puked. But in the 21 flights we did, there was an average of two or three unscheduled regurgitations per flight. So it was like, I think it was 58 total pukings by the end.
That's a NASA term, isn't it? You are unscheduled regurgitations. So,
yeah, exactly.
That's an industry term.
Damian Kulash and Tim Nordwin of OK Go. They'll be back after the break, and there's even more of our conversation online at planetary.org/radio. This is Planetary Radio.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. My guests are Damian Kulash and Tim Nordwin. If you haven't seen them and their OK Go bandmates Dan and Andy cavort in zero-G, come on. Go see it right now before you hear the rest of our conversation. We've got a link on the show page you can reach from planetary.org/radio.
Astronauts learn real fast that weightless doesn't mean massless. So you guys, all those incredible props you were playing with, some of them pretty heavy. I mean, laptops and things like that. Kind of dangerous. I mean, how did you keep everybody from being beamed by something?
We didn't.
Everyone got knocked around, you know, knocked by computers and balls and, you know, whatever else that was flying around. The important thing, I think, was just to try, when double gravity returned, try not to be under something, because that would have been really heavy.
I'm a fan of all the videos, but one that stands out for me is Palabolas, your work with them, your collaboration with them. You guys have certainly opened the door, but have you thought about what a dance company would be able to do in this microgravity environment? Let's say on the International Space Station, where you would have more than 30 seconds at a time.
Amazing things could be done. Truly amazing things could be done. You know, there was a big difference between our abilities up there and the aerialist acrobats who came prepared to hurl themselves around in incredible ways. You know, the amazing control they had over their bodies and the way they could control their inertia was, it's just, I mean, that's what dancers do, right? So given the opportunity, a good dance company could do a lot better than what we did.
Or just a lot different than what we did.
Yeah, right.
Is it been there, done that now? Or if Elon Musk called you up tomorrow and said, I want to take you up to the ISS, the space station, what would you say?
Yes.
I'd say yes.
All of these things come with a certain kind of, you have to have an adventuring streak in you in the first place to want to do anything like this. And to be offered an adventure like going to space would be a very hard one to turn down.
We are speaking, 2 days before the actual release of the video. I expect as big a reaction as you've gotten to anything else that you've done. And you've gotten some pretty big reactions. I mean, we're talking, 60 million views now, nearly, for some of them. I'd be shocked if you don't achieve that with this.
I hope this one spreads far and wide. We'll see. The internet video world has changed so much in the 10 years that we've been making stuff like this. When we first put out the treadmill video, it was a shock to everyone, especially the music industry, that something that was just cool and compelling could take on this life of its own. now there are Madison Avenue firms dedicated just to attempting to make that happen. I'm super excited that we've managed to get in sort of under that wire, you know, that we're able to still, we carved out a place where we can make these crazy things and still sort of have a platform to do it. I think it'd be a lot harder if we were a young band right now to be like, hey, we're just going to make some cool thing and hope it does well on the internet.
I got one more question for you. The boss, the science guy, here's the question that he wanted us to pass along to you.
Greetings, OK Go. Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society. Very impressed with your works. Love them. Why do you make them? I mean, I know why I do what I do, because it's science. But why do you do what you do? OK, go.
Science? Art?
Yeah, I guess we do what we do for the same reason, because it's science and art. I don't know how we'd do something else. We like chasing our most exciting creative ideas, and we're lucky that we live in a time when that can go anywhere. You know, it almost always starts with just straight up songwriting for us, but they lead into these crazy places where we wind up with a large scale science project a few months later, and it's all come from this song, and that is so exciting to us. The idea that we can chase our creative urges and it can go into filmmaking and it can go into art and it can go into science. And I really can't think of a more sort of fulfilling life than getting to just chase those creative ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, we really enjoy the joy of making stuff, and we really enjoy the joy of making stuff together. We've been friends a long time, and then to get to share it and to have people see it and enjoy it is just incredibly thrilling.
I cannot tell you how envious I am for the experiences that you've had, not just the ones inducing regurgitation, but all the amazing stuff you've done and the inspiration that it provides. So I'll thank you for that, and specifically for one little, second and a half shot of a certain Mars rover that showed up in your Rube Goldberg machine.
Oh, yeah. In our Rube Goldberg machine, several of the engineers we were working with were JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory folks, and so they slipped in some of their own references to their own work, which we were super excited about.
Yeah, it's a nice little Easter egg.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Best of luck with this video and everything that is yet to come. Like millions of other folks out there, I can't wait to see what comes next.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Time once again for What's Up on Planetary Radio. We are actually sitting at California State University, Dominguez Hills, at the anchor desk with the host of, it's the astronomy class, right? Once again?
It is indeed. So it's my introduction to planetary science and astronomy class, Physics 195 at California State University, Dominguez Hills.
That's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. He is Dr. Bruce Betts. This is, fourth or fifth time you've done this?
Even more. So we're doing a great class. People can find it online at planetary.org/BettsClass, B-E-T-T-S class, and watch the archive videos or tune in next time to watch it live.
And I hear from a lot of people, a lot of listeners to the radio show, who are big fans of yours. There's the guy who just wanted to know if he could offer you an apple.
I prefer chocolate, but I'm beyond bribery, but I still enjoy chocolate.
So here's how we roll. What's up, Bruce?
So up in the evening sky, you can still check out Jupiter in the early evening, mid-evening, rising over in the east. But the real display of planets is still in the pre-dawn sky. Mercury very low in the east in the pre-dawn, but then super bright Venus, easier to see low in the east. Going up to Saturn and then Mars, and almost on the other side of the sky, bright Jupiter. So check out the rare five planets that are visible with your naked eye.
Is there going to be a quiz?
Well, there will be for the class, but no, not for the planets. But I do point out for the students, and we're holding the class, I'm going to ask you to see planets and record when you saw them. Now's a really good time to do it. We move on to this week in space history. It was 3 years ago, 2013, that out of the sun came the 18-meter asteroid that impacted and blew up over Chelyabinsk, Russia, injuring more than 1,000 people, shattering glass, reminding us that asteroid threat is real, if infrequent.
Now, to be clear, the sun didn't throw it at us. It just made it really hard to see, right?
I can neither confirm nor deny it. All right, we move on. Random space my aunt. Tying into my class, that is, I've just been talking about the electromagnetic spectrum and what colors things emit at with temperature. The sun, it's going to be a pretty straightforward one, but a lot of people are confused. The sun is white. It is not yellow. It is white. It peaks in the visible part of the spectrum, but emits light all across white. We often think of it as yellow or reddish because when we do see it, we typically see it around sunset or sunrise, where the light's going through a lot of atmosphere, and only the longer wavelengths, like the yellows, oranges, and reds, make it through. By the way, do not stare at the midday sun or the sun in general to prove that it's white. Just trust me. And also, pictures often show I have colors or tints to the filter that make it confusing.
Then why do we call it a yellow star?
Because we're wrong.
Well, you heard it here.
Does explain, by the way, why you don't see stars that are green in the sky, because they're actually white. We move on to the trivia contest, and I asked you, in Earth days, how long is a Pluto day? How long does it take for Pluto to rotate? And because they are synchronously locked, this is also the length of a Charon day, moon of Pluto. How do we do, Matt?
I think this is just sort of the new normal. We have more listeners than ever before, so we're getting more entries than ever before. But still, a good chance of making it through random.org if you've got the right answer. And I believe that that's what Bernadetta Dedenate did. Oh, Magdalen College, Oxford, the UK. I was in Oxford last summer. What a great town. Just fantastic walking around with all the colleges there. So Bernadetta, she said, it's about 6.4 Earth days. Is she correct?
That is correct.
Ooh, Bernadetta, congratulations. You are the winner of the big prize package this week. Of course, a lovely Planetary Radio t-shirt, a 200-point iTelescope.net account for that worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes, and a year in space desk calendar and wall calendar. Those are cool. Bruce and I both contribute to those. Bernadetta added, love listening about the frontiers of our universe while working on some of the smallest organisms on Earth, i.e. viruses.
Ew.
He doesn't like squishy stuff very much. From Ryan Durier, who listens to us with his brother in Thousand Oaks, California. Who knows, might be part of this class. He says, I read that after its three-hour journey, the sunlight that reaches Pluto is more like moonlight than daylight. Probably makes Pluto a romantic place for dinner, but I hear it's lacking in atmosphere.
Ah, it is about 1/1600th the Ooh. Brightness of the sun. I mean, there's a little thin atmosphere, but it would be really unhealthy to have that be the only thing you're breathing. All right, here's your new question. Tied back into sunlight, what is the peak wavelength of the sun's electromagnetic radiation, of the light coming from the sun? What is the peak, the wavelength that has the highest amount of it, the wavelength nodule? Be approximate. So say to the nearest, just the nearest 100 nanometers. Go to planetary.org/radio contest to find out how to get us your entry. When do they need to get that in by, Matt?
The 23rd. That would be February 23rd at 8 a.m. Pacific time. We are going to give, for the last time, that same prize package. Well, the shirts will continue, and maybe itelescope.net, but it's getting pretty far into 2016, so this is the last chance to win the Year in Space desk and wall calendars, at least until December of this year for the 2017. And now we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what it's like to be surrounded by cameras.
Oh,
thank you.
God.
Good night.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here, well, not here at Dominguez Hills, but here for What's Up.
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our lighthearted members. Daniel Gunn is the associate producer. Josh Doyle wrote the theme music. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.